federal rollback of criminal justice reforms targeting a policy known as civil asset forfeiture could mean law enforcement can seize more of your property, even if you're not being arrested. Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Bankin for Melissa Ross. We're always live here at 9 and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. You can also hear our audio feed right now on the First Coast Connect Facebook page. And just ahead, lead writer for the Harvard Fair Punishment Project's Justice Today, Larry Hannon, on what the tweak to federal law enforcement may mean for Florida. Then later, a new WJCT initiative designed to move our reporting beyond the core, plus going green and travel with Judy Wells. All of that ahead, but first this hour, civil asset forfeiture. It's a procedure whereby law enforcement can seize your property if they think you've earned it through a criminal activity or if they suspect said property has been used in the commission of a crime. Asset forfeiture is an old practice that predates our modern era, but it didn't really gain prevalence until Prohibition in the 20s and then again during the start of the drug war some decades later. The rationale has always been that it can help put a dent in criminal activity by attacking criminal enterprises like drug cartels and mafias where it hurts the most, the wallet. But in recent years, the policy has come under fire by criminal justice reformists on both sides of the political aisle who say it's fundamentally unconstitutional, mainly because most assets law enforcement seizes are from individuals who are never really charged with a crime. The Obama administration, though generally supportive of most law enforcement traditions, sought to roll back its use by federal agencies, killing the Justice Department's equitable sharing program. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has revived it. Give us a call with your thoughts on civil asset forfeiture. Have you experienced it before? 549-2937. Again, that's 549-2937. So again, here to explain what the program is and how it affects Florida is the Fair Punishment Project's Larry Hannon. Larry, thanks for being here.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start off. I know I kind of did a little bit of a short explainer on what it is, but let's dig into a little bit here of the obvious. Mm-hmm. What is civil asset forfeiture and what makes it different from other like criminal proceedings?
Well, civil asset forfeiture basically allows law enforcement to seize your property. If they think you've done something wrong or engaged in criminal activity, they can come in, they can take your boats, they can take your house, they can take your car, and it's very difficult to get it back. And the thing that frustrates a lot of people on the left and the right is that you don't have to be charged with a crime for them to do this. In fact, very often, you're never charged with a crime, and if you want to get your property back, you basically have to go to court and prove you didn't do something bad, which is a complete inversion of the way it's supposed to be. You know, in criminal law, you're innocent until proven guilty. When it comes to civil asset forfeiture, you're guilty till proven innocent.
You know, and I think a lot of people are surprised about this specific legal proceeding because the way that it's conducted seems very strange to us, right? Because the actual property is basically on trial,
correct,
right?
The actual property is on trial, and anyone who's ever been through a court proceeding can tell you it's very hard to go to court and do something like this. And oftentimes, people just let the property go because they determine the cost of hiring a lawyer, of getting something done, is going to be more expensive than the value of the property itself. And quite frankly, I think a lot of law enforcement knows that, and that's one of the reasons they feel so free to seize a lot of things.
What are your questions about civil asset forfeiture and a change of the Department of Justice rolling back some reforms that were made under the Obama administration? Give us a call, 549-2937, or comment on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Again, 549-2937. So what exactly changed here with the DOJ and Attorney General Jeff Sessions?
Well, the Obama administration had been phasing it out. It was still used in some instances, but for the most part, they were discouraging it. Jeff Sessions came in and basically said, no, we want to aggressively do this. And so, you know, it's obviously still early in the Trump administration, and Lord knows Jeff Sessions has some other problems he has to deal with. But right. He has basically said civil asset forfeiture keeps us safe. And we want to aggressively do that with people we think are committing crimes.
And this isn't necessarily a surprise, right? Jeff No. Sessions is of the tough-on-crime school of thought.
Jeff Sessions has basically never left the 80s when it comes to his criminal. He believes in the drug war. He believes that marijuana should be illegal. He believes in civil asset forfeiture. These are all positions that were popular in the 1980s. Many of them have now been discredited, or at least there's significant data to suggest it doesn't work, but Sessions still believes in all of this.
And we're going to go to your calls in just a moment. 549-2937 if you want to join the conversation. So this equitable sharing program basically allowed local law enforcement to essentially partner with the federal government and share in the profits of what was seized.
Correct. And this is something that drives a lot of civil liberties nuts, because as we all know, local law enforcement, local prosecutors sometimes struggle to get funding. It's a battle every year. Well, here's a chance for them to get money that they don't have to ask the state legislature or the city government for, but because they're allowed to share in the proceeds, it basically encourages them to seize as much property as they can. And so you sometimes have law enforcement that really is relying on civil asset forfeiture. And if you're a police officer or a prosecutor who thinks, well, there's a budget crisis coming up and I could lose my job, then obviously you're going to be motivated to be as aggressive as possible when it comes to seizing civil assets, even with people who you can't prove are committing a crime.
And we're going to get into the specifics behind Florida, because every state is a little bit different. Some states have passed outright bans, and some states like Florida mm-hmm. have passed some more regulations dealing yeah. with it. But this new move by Attorney General Jeff Sessions would basically supersede anything the states have put in place. But let's go to your calls as we're getting some jammed lines here. Dale in St. Augustine. Dale, you're on the line.
Yeah, this just seems like additional extortion by the law enforcement community or the law enforcement agency, whether it be federal or local. I mean, the same thing happens with bail bondsmen and people, kids get arrested for weed and the $300 lawyers and everything else. It's just using the law enforcement to extort money and fines. I think in Lottie, it's the funding for speeding tickets. You know, it's just in effect extortion by the law enforcement of the community or of the people to generate revenue to run the officers. I had the same thing happen in Mexico in the 1980s when an officer pulled me over and for $20 he let me go. But you know, if I didn't give him the $20, he was going to take me to jail. It's just a bigger form of that is obviously what it is. It's not anything more than extortion by the law enforcement agencies.
Thank you for your comments, Dale. So what about that? He's calling it extortion, and mm-hmm. but legally speaking, what decisions, at least in Florida, have been made by courts regarding how this is seen?
Now, legally, what he just described in Mexico is bribery.
That's bribery, right? And I've experienced that in Nicaragua as well.
Yes,
but yeah,
which is different. though some people would say underneath it's the same. You know, seven states and the District of Columbia basically block law enforcement access to forfeiture proceeds. There's a lot of other jurisdictions that allow maybe 45%. And in Florida, the figure is 85% of the value of forfeited property that can be directed to law enforcement. So Florida can get more money from civil asset forfeiture than a lot of other states.
But it doesn't necessarily work, like, let's say, you know, it doesn't work from cash from a suspect's car into the coffers directly of law enforcement. What's the process?
Well, it's a long process, and it varies depending on each. You know, oftentimes it has to be held for a period of time. The person who is seized does have the right to ask for it back. Oftentimes it gets split. If they seize a boat, for example, a deputy sheriff is not going to be able to take that boat and own it. It's going to be auctioned off. It's not unusual. You know, a couple of times a year, sheriff's departments often hold auctions where they auction off things they've seized via civil asset forfeiture. And then usually the money is split in some way between the federal government and the state governments, and sometimes the local entities as well.
Has there, and before we go to some more calls really quickly, has there been any cases of people who've had their property seized and then get it back through some of these auctions or something like
you know,
that?
I've never heard of that happening. You know, it's more you go, you know, if you're going to spend the money in auction, you're going to spend the money to go to court to get it back.
Right.
And the thing is that it's just very hard to get it back. You know, I was just looking yesterday. There was one case in Arizona where a property owner was acquitted of all criminal charges, and she still lost her house to civil forfeiture. And when she tried to get it back, they said, no, you legally, the cops can do this. So it's frustrating in that way that, like I said, guilty until proven innocent. And sometimes even when you're proven innocent, you still can't get it back.
549-2937, that's the number to call if you want to get on the line and talk civil asset forfeiture. What are your opinions, comments, or questions? Jody on the south side. Jody, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was just hoping you could talk a little bit more about the connection between the property and the act of the seizure itself. In other words, what is the basis or the various bases that law enforcement can seize what property, and what the legal burden might be for getting it back a little bit more specifically, if possible.
Sure, sure, sure. Of course, Jody. Thanks. That's a great question. Yeah. In Florida, there's a probable cause that has to factor in.
You have to say there's probable cause to believe this individual is engaged in a criminal enterprise, and at that point, they can seize property.
They don't have to prove it.
Don't have to prove it. No, it's like getting a search warrant. You know, getting a search warrant does not require you to prove someone has done something wrong. There's just probable reason to believe it exists. And the problem with that is because it's basically the same standard, they can take it for that reason. And as for the procedure for getting it back, it's really tough to say what the procedure is because you have to basically prove your innocence. And a lot of, you know, oftentimes police won't say, well, we investigated this person and we've determined they did nothing wrong. They just tend to say it's a pending investigation, which makes it almost impossible for someone to get their property back.
Like a purgatory of investigation.
Yeah. And there's also the fear that, you know, if let's say someone comes and says, well, the police took my house. And the person says, well, and a lawyer says, well, you're under criminal investigation. And they say, I don't know. The lawyer says, well, I don't want to take you to court and argue that because you could say something that would incriminate yourself. So it's very rare for people to get civil asset forfeiture seizures back for that reason, because, you know, a lawyer is most concerned about the possible criminal charges they could face. And no lawyer wants to bring his client in and have him say something that ends up getting them thrown in jail.
Right. We've got some more calls that we're going to go to in just a moment here. But I want to talk a little bit about your experience in Jacksonville. Obviously, before going to the Fair Punishment Project, you did a lot of reporting on criminal justice issues for the Times Union. Can you remember in recent memory any stories that you experienced or worked on here in Jacksonville having to do with civil forfeiture?
You know, I can't, and that's largely just because, you know, we have the murder capital of Florida. We tended to, when I wrote about things, I tended to focus on murders. I didn't really focus a lot on civil asset forfeiture. This has been kind of an eye-opener for me when I went to Fair Punishment, just because it's an issue that really has united liberals and a lot of conservatives as well. And quite frankly, any issue where liberals and conservatives are joining forces in this day and age.
Post-2016.
Yeah. And what's fascinating is we even have a lot of Republicans in Congress who say this is wrong. But nonetheless, the Trump administration and Jeff Sessions are very supportive of civil asset forfeiture.
Oh, and we have seen some of our own state representatives that are part of the GOP be very loudly critical of this on social media. We'll get to that in just a moment here. I want to get to some more calls. Susan on the south side. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi. I was curious how the landlords with rental property works. If a renter is doing something illegal, is the landlord liable, you know, will they get their assets seized?
Oh, thank you, Susan. That's a very good question I didn't think about.
The landlord can be liable, but you have to basically argue the landlord knew criminal activity was going on in the facility or that the landlord didn't care. So, I mean, there have been some properties seized when criminal activity just continues all the time. It's rare, but there have been situations where there's a house that's been a drug you know, a drug den, and you know, they arrest people, new people move in, and the drugs continue, and the cops do eventually seize that.
Because if you have multiple people moving in and the same thing is happening, mm-hmm. then they're saying, well, then the homeowner probably knows.
Exactly. And so that does happen, but it's for the most – that's not the main problem with civil asset forfeiture. It tends to be what people own. And the other, you know, the other concern is sometimes there are people who, let's say you live in a house and you rent a room to someone else and that person turns out to be selling drugs. Well, the police sometimes can seize all your property, arguing you had a hand in it, even if you didn't. And that's a situation where it becomes very hard to prove you're innocent because you have to basically prove a negative in a way, and that's a real challenge.
The number is 549-2937 to give us your thoughts on civil asset forfeiture. Dave is in Kingsland, Georgia. Dave, you have a very particular question.
Hi. I haven't heard anybody raise the question of whether there's been a Supreme Court case on constitutionality.
Sure.
I'll take my answer off radio.
Sure. Thank you, Dave. Thank you for that. Yeah, it has there been, I mean, I know that there's been a number of court cases, but any really big seminal cases at the Supreme Court regarding this?
There have not been any rulings yet. There is actually a case coming up that a lot of people think could be a big one. But and as of right now, the Supreme Court has not ruled on this. And it's partly because it's all over the map who supports it and who opposes it. You know, for the most part, the police support civil asset forfeiture, prosecutors support it. But it's one of the, I think there's about six cases that are conflicting right now. And so I think eventually the U.S. Supreme Court's going to have to take a case and basically decide which, you know, what's actually legal. And I know there was one, I think, that just recently had oral arguments that hasn't been ruled on yet. So we may have a fairly important ruling coming down the pike very soon.
And, you know, I think it's worthy to mention that it's been sort of the political strategy almost, because Democrats are so weakened nationally, mm-hmm. For blue states to join together and sue the Trump administration the same way that red states did mm-hmm. During the Obama administration. And there are a lot of blue states who have very strict controls or bans mm-hmm. on civil forfeiture. So to your point, Dave, it may be possible. This is just speculation, but it could be possible that these states will file a challenge to this eventually because it preempts and supersedes their own laws. Right.
And all, you know, all the Democratic attorney generals in certain states are suing Trump as often as they can,
right.
So it wouldn't surprise me if they eventually band together on this as well.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about where they can agree, and we've got some calls, and fear not, we're going to get to them as soon as possible here. But I want to talk about what we mentioned, that this is sort of almost another issue that's an example of a bridge that's starting to form. And we've seen it here in Jacksonville with the election of Melissa Nelson and mm-hmm. and kind of a pre-trial prevention of crime and stuff like that. But this is another example where Republicans and Democrats seem to be coming to the table together. There's a Republican known as a very staunch conservative, Jamie Grant from Tampa, mm-hmm. who as soon as this rule was released, he's sort of known for these tweet storms, mm-hmm. but he just did this massive tweet storm about how he feels that it's against conservative principles. And so there's this shift. Can you tell us how this fits into the overall shift about how we talk about criminal justice?
Well, I would say let's focus on the conservatives at first. We live in a two-party system here in the United States, and that means the parties are broad coalitions of people who have very different interests. And I would say the libertarians, who are a part of the conservative coalition, are the ones who are most vocally against this. And they have
part of that three-legged stool.
And they don't like this at all, and they have fought against it for quite a while. And there are a lot of libertarian-leaning Republicans in the Florida Senate and the House. It's the whole attitude of, you can't touch my stuff, the value of property rights. And for people like that, this is a big deal, and it's something they do not like. And so to a certain extent, there's a little bit of a Republican civil war going on here. I think for the most part, the Democrat-liberal side, there has been broad support against this, though I would not say it's been a high-priority issue for liberals or Democrats up until now.
It doesn't seem to have been on their radar as much as the death penalty or some of these other criminal justice issues.
And then you have the whole issue that, you know, most politicians want to be supportive of police and prosecutors. Mm-hmm. Police and prosecutors like this. It's a tool in their toolbox. And so I think a lot of people, liberal and conservative, have been reluctant to buck the prosecutors because they like it and they don't want to be called anti-police or be accused of taking a tool from the toolbox that prosecutors and police say keeps the public safer.
Especially in election year, probably.
Exactly. And we're always coming up with an election year in one way or the other.
Right, right. Well, we're going to go to some more of your calls here. 549-2937. James in Lakewood. James, what's your question or comment?
Well, my comment was, it kind of piggybacks off what your guest just said. This is a tool for the police to use. You know, I can't speak to the jurisdictions, but I know here in Jacksonville, there's actually only one prosecutor that handles civil forfeitures here. And many times what happens is items or money are seized for forfeiture, and what results is a negotiation in which the person is given their stuff back. Oftentimes it'll be a motor vehicle, for instance. There's some question about an innocent owner perhaps being involved. They'll negotiate return of the vehicle, perhaps for some payment. If there's some cash seized, they might keep part of that, with the caveat that if it's involved in criminal activity again, you're probably not going to get it back. Like anything else, this tool can be abused, but the courts very closely scrutinize these cases. There's a lot of litigation that surrounds forfeitures in this state, and at least in my experience, and I have a lot of experience with it, they're not undertaken injudiciously. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very carefully thought out, and if there's nothing there, they just don't take the property or they'll negotiate a return of it.
Okay, great. Thank you for your comments, James. So what about James's view here that, you know, in his experience, and I'm not entirely sure what he does for a living, but he says that he's experienced this firsthand, that there's a process that they go through to seize somebody's assets.
Right. I mean, there is a process, but, you know, the problem is that you can seize assets of people who haven't been charged with a crime. I have no reason to doubt what he says, that it's handled responsibly here. I really haven't heard many stories in the Jacksonville area of abuses this way. But the problem is, even if it's being handled responsibly, you're still counting on elected officials being responsible. And we all know there will be elected officials at some point who are not responsible. And as I said before, largely because there's a struggle to get funding for police and prosecutors in this state. You know, every year we have a major budget crunch. The impetus to really push this and seek to seize more stuff is always going to be tempting for police and prosecutors who are struggling to have a balanced budget.
All right, let's go to another of your calls. Frederick, you're in St. Augustine. Frederick, you are on the air.
Well, thank you. Obviously there are a lot of guilty people out there that need to be punished, but if someone's innocent or haven't committed a crime and they lose their home and their valuables, it seems to me that the criminal element, the criminal enterprise, is the government. I mean, and it just seems wrong. It just seems absolutely wrong.
Thank you, Frederick. So let's talk about public opinion here, right? Because we're getting a lot of calls, and of course this is anecdotal, but you know, in our modern era, there is a lot of opposition from the public to this kind of thing. I mean, most people, maybe they don't consider themselves libertarians or liberals, but they kind of feel a little icky about you know, this stuff being taken before a crime is committed.
The Cato Institute did a poll in December 2016, and that poll found that 84% were opposed to civil asset forfeiture. So the public has pretty much spoken about this. Now, I will say that a lot of people have no clue what civil asset forfeiture is, and I'm sure with that poll, people called, so what do you think? They said, what is this? They explained, and they said, oh, well, I don't like that. I know. I think you walk on the street and ask people about asset forfeiture, the vast majority will have no clue what you're talking about. But most people who study it and are aware of it are bothered by it and think that there are just ways this is being done that are problematic.
Now, this also brings up
the issue of disparities, mm-hmm. right? Because we know from data and very high profile cases that there is a tendency and has been the history of this country that certain populations are more vulnerable to, yes. to experiencing this kind of thing. Is that is the same true for civil forfeiture?
Very much so. You know, the court system is confusing and frustrating even to people with resources. If you are struggling to get by and the police seize some of your property and you don't have the money to hire a lawyer, or you just don't know a lawyer, as many people don't, it's very, a lot of people don't even know how to do it. They don't know yet. They have to go to court to get it. They don't know how to do that. They don't may not even know where the courthouse is. And that's, you know, I've seen people wandering the Duval County Courthouse, and I covered when I covered courts for the Times Union, and they would come up to me and say, I need to pay child support, or I need to get an injunction. Where do I go? I mean, mm-hmm. it's a very hard process for people to go through. It's challenging for people who don't understand how the legal system works. And, you know, that tends to be people who are minorities. It tends to be people who are not college graduates. And it's just for a lot of people, it's just so hard and so scary that they would rather just move on with their lives and accept the fact that what was seized is gone.
Right. Nathan in Riverside. Nathan, you're on the air.
Hey. So comment and question. Comment, you know, I want to say thank you so much for pointing out that most people do think civil asset forfeiture is kind of icky. You know, it's something that most people don't really enjoy or even want to think of. But as far as being preemptive, you know, we're covering the idea that once you get your assets taken, what can you do? But is there anything that we could do ahead of time? Let's say we might be in threat of getting our assets taken away from us, or even right now, you know, calling your local officials. What can we do preemptively to either stop this or to just make sure that we are more protected if we're in threat of getting our assets taken?
Sure. Thank you, Nathan.
I think calling your local representatives and encouraging them to oppose civil asset forfeiture is a good idea. Now, if someone's actually looking at you as being if you're being suspected of a crime, I think any criminal defense attorney would tell you to shut up and not worry about your property being seized, because you're in more of a, if you're actually facing the danger of being criminally charged, that's a much more serious thing than having your assets seized. And they, as I said before, that's one of the challenges of people getting it back, is they have to prove they're innocent. And a lot of times their lawyers don't want them to go out and do that, because they could, in theory, incriminate themselves by saying that.
And just a number that I want to throw out here that's been widely reported for a while. The Justice Department Inspector General's report in April found that federal forfeiture programs had taken in almost $28 billion. Now, for comparison, the Florida state budget was about $80 billion mm-hmm. this last session. Yeah. So you're talking about, close to half, $28 billion.
Here, a billion there, that adds up to real money.
Right. We've got another call. David in Fernandina Beach. David, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. How are you?
Good. How are you? What's your question or comment?
My question, sir, is I did this for a while, and I retired from a three-letter agency. And I did asset forfeiture with DOJ. I did DAGs to give the percentages back to the locals. DOJ generally DAGs back 80% to the state locals. And that money was used for training and resources to assist the local PDs to fight the wars on criminal enterprises, whether it was the drug war or any type of other crimes that the agencies were going after. I targeted criminal organizations, and we took away their money. And if you know anything about the strategy of going after crime, you take away a criminal's money, you effectively reduce his effectiveness.
Sort of like the Elliot Ness going after Capone for tax evasion kind of thing.
I never went after anybody who was innocent. The people we went against were moving a lot of drugs between Miami and Atlanta, Georgia. There were interdiction stops on 95 and I-4 by certain state highway patrols, and they would seize money from, you know, from these criminals. You know, you're talking $50,000 to $100,000. And then when we did our research on them, you know, DOJ is just not a wand and you take money from people. It's highly vetted, the process that DOJ uses to seize money. And it's just not going after innocent people. You know, we have a certain procedure. We had to write up a very large summary of why we're seizing it. We had to also do research on them to see through the Florida waste system to see if these people held jobs. Their criminal record was held into account. And then attorneys at DOJ would make the determination if we could seize that money civilly. So
right.
I don't want the public to be misconstrued about what you're saying, because law enforcement is doing this to target the criminals. And, you know, and this is, I did this for 20 years. And we got a lot of money from criminal organizations. And most Americans are out there making minimum wage. You're working hard. And you got these criminals out there that are selling drugs, selling guns. They're making money. And if you don't go after that asset, that financial asset, when they'll use that money to hire private attorneys and use that money to fight you in court, and chances are they'll win. And if they have that money, they can use it for training, for buying other drugs, for buying weapons. So that's why I think you need to bring that out, sir.
Sure. Thank you, David. I appreciate the call. So, yeah, we had talked about that, about the process to seize someone's assets. And, yes, the thought has always been that you can use this process in order to kind of pull the rug out from under large criminal enterprises. So before we end this segment, tell me a little bit more about your thoughts on that. He's saying, you know, these are criminals that we know that they're criminals.
Well, they may know they're criminals, but they haven't always proven they're criminals. I mean, you have to prove, someone has the presumption of innocence in a court of law until they're convicted. Every person who goes before a judge and a jury is innocent when the trial starts. And the challenge with this is that if you seize their property before you prove they're guilty, you have a, you know, when suddenly they're guilty until proven innocent, which is not the way our system works. Now, I understand the argument that, you know, we want to kneecap these criminal organizations and take away their money. It's a valid concern. But at the same time, you know, we want people to, you know, our whole process is based on the fact that you're innocent until proven guilty, and civil asset forfeiture turns that on its head.
All right. Well, we could probably take a whole hour or more on this subject alone. But thank you, Larry Hannon. He is the lead writer for the Fair Punishment Project's Justice Today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll be right back.
Next time on 1A, sharing stories. Publishing was one of the first big businesses to be disrupted by technology. But the way we exchange and share our favorite books is changing too. We'll speak to Todd Bowl, the founder of The Little Free Library, a movement that helps thousands of Americans share millions of books. Todd Bowl and the Future of Libraries. Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Ever wonder what happens to your car parts after your old clunker finally kicks the bucket? Well, the most environmentally safe option is having the empty husk of your petrified sedan repurposed by operations like Go Auto Recycling. Go Auto recycles everything from aluminum and iron to thousands of gallons of gas and oil a year. Here to tell us more is Nick Fior, the general manager for Go Auto Recycling. Nick, thanks for being here.
Sure. No problem.
So the first question that I always like to start off with, just give me a little bit of a history lesson on Go Auto Recycling.
So Go Auto Recycling was founded in 2009. We're a local business. In 2014, we became a part of a public company that had 16 locations, throughout the East Coast of the United States and Canada.
Growing.
Yeah, growing in leaps and bounds. So it's something that went from a business that was doing a couple $100,000 in sales a year to over 10 million over 10 million in our site. So
you have some numbers here that you shared with us that I think are pretty astonishing as to how much you can recycle in a single year. How much does Go Auto actually recycle of a car? What parts are really what you deal with?
Sure. So each car has about a ton of scrap metal in it, right? So whether you were able to extract a ton of steel or not, is probably questionable, but somewhere about. Also the aluminum, plastic, copper, brass, platinum, palladium. We recycle the batteries. I mean, almost all automotive batteries are recycled. And now with hybrid vehicles, those lithium ion batteries are really valuable, and there's a secondary market for recycling them.
And there's not really much you can do with a lithium ion battery specifically aside from recycling it, right? Because once it's used up, it's kind of toxic to sit in a landfill like that.
It is, absolutely, absolutely. So, and on top of that, we harvest the good auto parts out of them and reuse them in other vehicles, whether it's through the collision industry. So if your car gets in an accident, you might have the option of getting a used door that comes from us. And we also recycle all the fluids, like you mentioned, so the gasoline and the oil and Freon.
So tell me how this is what I'm really interested in, because I found this fascinating. What do you do with these fluids after they're recycled? Like, what's the process for recycling them, and how are they used later?
Interesting question. So we handle, and it's, auto recycling is a highly regulated industry. So
right.
we have very strict rules that we have to follow, but we are responsible for the defluiding process. I mean, we separate it, we get it into the appropriate container, and then there are companies that come by that are part of our industry that then take that fluid and recycle it. So we don't actually do anything other than just make sure it gets out of the vehicle and doesn't get into the ground.
Okay, great. Okay. So that was the one thing that I was like, I think it was 1,000... I'm trying to figure out the number here. 1,000 gallons of either gas or oil, or 1,000 gallons of used oil and over 3,000 gallons of gasoline each year.
Yeah, yeah. And the more vehicles we do, obviously, the more. I mean, if you go to the Automotive Recyclers Association's website, they'll tell you that, as a business or an industry, we do about 4 million vehicles a year. And in those 4 million vehicles a year, there's about 8 million gallons of gasoline. So, it's a pretty significant, and we reuse the gasoline in our own local trucks. So the stuff that we take out of cars, we put right back into our trucks, and we'll do the same thing with coolant or the windshield wiper fluid.
Yeah, there you go. Then that's one less expense. And it gets used instead of sitting around.
I can guarantee it's recycled.
Right. So tell me a little bit about the products that you sell to the end user that are recycled. What, obviously batteries, but what else?
So when we say that, we take end of life vehicles and make sure they don't get in a landfill, right? There's really two ways that your vehicle reaches the end of its useful life. Sometimes you get in an accident and it's a total loss, and then sometimes you're just like, hey, this thing's just no longer worth repairing, right? I love it. So
right.
We kind of get them both ways, right? And the vehicles that we get that are total loss vehicles and the other ones, for the most part, we sell doors, we sell fenders. I mean, we will really sell, if there's a market for it, we'll sell it. And we're constantly amazed by the things that people will now purchase on eBay, let's just say, that we don't even know was a really expensive part until, we kind of find out about it, secondhand.
And so if somebody says, I think my car is reaching the end of its life, and I need to go get a new one. I'm not really sure what to do with it, but I don't just want to take it to your average junkyard. How do they get in contact with Go Auto Recycling, and how do they get it to you?
Sure. So Go Auto Recycling has a sister company called Go Pull It. It's on Commonwealth Avenue. Both are modern recycling facilities. One is more the kind of place where you go and pull your own part, and I will certainly at Go Auto supply you with an auto part. But we kind of take care of that for you. You don't have to come and pull it. We are very much a full service facility. But Go Pull It would be a great place for you to take your car, and you can find information at GoPullIt.com.
And if you're a AAA member, like for instance, if your car can't move from where it is, if you're a AAA member,
they will absolutely come get it. They will take care of the whole thing for you, and they'll pay you a fair market price for really at that point what this deal's worth on the car.
Great. So people can actually make some of their money back in that as well.
Yeah, they might be mad at me for saying they'd actually pay for the car, so if people were willing to just drive them on down there. But they'll give you, might be, it depends on what the scrap market's doing. The scrap market happens to be up a little bit. So, you can probably get $200 or $300 at least for something that, at the moment is a lawn ornament.
So you're joining us for what we do called our Going Green segment, and everything is about being environmental responsibility. This may seem like a really obvious question because, duh, recycling. But how does Go Auto Recycling see itself environmentally? How does it help shrink people's footprints? What is so good about recycling these auto parts?
So when you recycle a ton of steel, right? So a ton of steel, new steel takes about 1,200 pounds of coal, right, to produce, plus all of the iron ore and that mining process. So every time you recycle a car, you're saving 1,200 pounds of coal. So just at Go, wow, in a single year, we save about 2 million pounds of coal. So that certainly, I think, is pretty significant. At the end of the day, if I describe this to my 5-year-old daughter, daddy goes to work and he takes people's old cars and makes them into new cars. On a real simple level, that's what we do. And really, it is very fortunate that recycling is a byproduct of our manufacturing process. I mean, there's hardworking people that are in our business that do what they do, and they get to go home at night and just know that, hey, at the very least, we're recycling. And it's just what we do.
Right. Well, Nick Fior is the general manager for Go Auto Recycling, and he joins us this morning talking about car recycling and how it can help the environment. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
Back in a moment.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Chefs who need exotic and hard-to-find ingredients are turning to refugees, farmers who know how to grow them.
We're able to sort of highlight a skill they bring to the United States and give restaurants access to locally grown food like that.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a gardening win-win, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back to First Coast Connect on WJCT. Well, it just seems like Florida summers keep getting hotter. And, well, talk to a climate scientist and they'll tell you that they probably are. So turn your thermostat down, close your eyes, and take a trip to the Arctic with none other than Judy Wells.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
And it's nice and cold up there, believe me.
Yeah, I imagine.
It's cold at the ends of the earth.
I imagine. So we're going to talk about that. We're also going to talk about the upcoming eclipse if we have some time here at the end. But tell us a little bit about Expedition Cruises and specifically Poseidon's East Greenland Cruise.
This was Western Greenland.
Oh, Western. Oh, I'm sorry. Uh-huh. West Greenland.
But when you book a cruise, you usually do it on the basis of itinerary, dates, and price. With Expedition Cruises, you can count on two of those, but you can't count on one, because Expedition Cruises go where the extraordinary is ordinary, and often you are limited by conditions totally out of your control. But you get some excitement other ways. You
right.
find new things. Greenland is interesting because it's the world's largest island. It's three times the size of France, with a coastline longer than the Earth's circumference, yet only 56,000 people live there. 56,001 if you count Santa Claus.
Right, right.
Also,
well, and Mrs. Claus.
Yeah, it's the mother of icebergs. One glacier we expected to visit on this cruise calves 20 billion tons of them a year.
Wow.
That's a lot of floating ice.
So I imagine you're not spending a whole lot of time, depending on when you're going, but almost any time of the year, on the deck of the ship, though, right? I mean,
well,
it's pretty
bitter
cold.
We spend a lot of time out there. It's cold, but with Poseidon, you get, and you get to keep, your polar parka.
Oh, wow.
Which is nice and bright, international, red and reddish-orange, and is very warm. So we spent a lot of time taking pictures on deck.
Right.
But we also spent a fair amount of time in zodiacs and on land.
Uh-huh.
We visited villages. They're really colorful because there's no wood in Greenland, and there's not a lot of color either. And they love bright colors. So the houses and the buildings are all in bright, bright primary colors primarily.
Hmm. With that kind of gray backdrop backdrop.
Well, when we were on the first cruise of the season, which is your iffiest when it comes to itinerary, but it's also the most likely one to be discounted.
Oh, I see.
Which
that's key.
Big incentive. We did Bear Island, which is in the Nook Fjord, and we had fun with that. That was like nature's sculpture garden with bergie bits and growlers, the smaller ice chunks, in wonderful shapes. It was like sculpture. Winter had been exceptionally harsh this year, and the sea ice, which is frozen salt water, was still too thick to navigate a lot of places. We were going to go farther up in the fjord, but we had to turn around and go back and head it out to sea. We crossed the Arctic Circle several times and were, initiated with a splash of polar water on our heads. We were amazed at the young expedition team who managed to get us places, find alternative sites to land and to go to when we couldn't go where the itinerary said. Chefs were great. We didn't make it to that prolific glacier or very far into Disko Bay because of the sea life. And Disko Bay is where a lot of the wildlife is. However, we saw snow-covered mountains when the clouds were lifted. We were serenaded by the Nook Choir. We experienced the midnight sun and days where there was little change in light from morning to night. We had a few firsts of going places where tourists hadn't gone before. We also saw bowhead whales, which are huge. You know, a humpback is about 40 tons. These are 100 tons.
Wow.
And 64 feet in length. And we were in an area just on the edge of Disko Bay, and we saw a whole pod of them going around. We had a very exciting thing, the most exciting first adventure we had. We weren't able to get the ship up to the end of the fjord where we were to go from to the airport to go home. So they arranged to take our luggage on a net lift to the airport by helicopter. They had a choice of two places we were to go. We could go that the helicopter could get. We were literally airlifted out of a deserted settlement by a Sikorsky helicopter.
Well, that sounds like quite the adventure. And
it was. Now, Poseidon has been in the polar expedition specifically, for 18 years in the Arctic and Antarctic. And that hadn't happened to them either. So it was a first for all of us. And that's a great story to take home with your parka. But it's the sign of a well-run cruise expedition that knows its territory and has excellent relationships with other sources there.
Well, Judy Wells, thank you for telling us about the expedition cruises and specifically Poseidon. But we're running out of some time here. So
We always do.
Thank you so much for joining us. And now, finally, this morning, we here at WJCT do our best to bring you as much important news from around the city of Jacksonville as we possibly can cover. But we want to do a better job. We want to do it even better. Much of your local news outlets, ourselves included, seem to focus more on the urban core. And WJCT News Director Jessica Palumbo is here to tell us a little bit about our initiative to get beyond that.
Right. And it's called Beyond the Core, Ryan. I'm excited to talk about it this morning, finally, because we all know that the First Coast is a big place. And even if you grew up here, like I did, it's sometimes hard for us to get outside of our bubbles, right? And as reporters, you and I are lucky because we get to talk to different people all the time.
Oh, yeah.
But for most of us, we may rarely or never interact with anyone outside of our core communities. So WJCT wants to help the whole city go beyond the core. Now, what does that mean? Okay, so we're going on a listening tour. We're going to six different areas of town over the next 6 months or so, and we'll get to know people in all of these communities, and then we'll follow up with stories to help the rest of the city understand each community a little better, hopefully.
And so, the first listening session is tonight, right?
Yes, yes. And we're so excited. Our first listening session is at NAS Jax. The first community that we're focusing on is Navy families. If you come to one of our sessions, you should know that it's off the record. Then that means reporters have to switch off reporter mode, not record, not take photos. We're not attributing information to any specific person. And the goal is just to listen, because no matter how much we think we might know your community, nobody knows what it's like to live in your part of town like you do.
So where else are we going on tour?
Like I said, we'll be visiting six areas. Check our website, wjctnews.org, and keep an eye on our Facebook page for updates with specific dates and locations. And if you're with a neighborhood association who might want to partner with us and bring us out for a session in your neighborhood, reach out to us. You can email us at news@wjct.org, and we hope to meet you beyond the core this year.
Well, that's WJCT News Director Jessica Palumbo. Thanks, Jess.
Thanks, Ryan.
And that's our show for today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. Next on 1A, do the president's attacks hurt his party more than his foes? I'm Ryan Bank, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow with our media round. We'll be back again at 9 a.m. tomorrow with events from Carrie Speckman. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.